Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm Bruce Bellingham, and I want to welcome you to tonight's meeting of InForum. That's the division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and in their 30s. It has a mission to inspire debate around civic and social issues. Tonight we're going to discuss the Summer of Love. Most of you have heard of it. It's about the legacy of activism and civic engagement that's evolved since that infamous Summer of Love. Excuse me. You know, I've never handled the gavel before. It's very intimidating. That infamous Summer of Love, storied, legendary, and any other adjective we've been applying to it lately. The Summer of Love transformed San Francisco into a hotbed of activism with the mantra of peace and love and resistance. There were sit-ins, lie-ins, be-ins, protests, and parades. It caused an entire generation to stand up against the Vietnam War. Protest today is largely driven by email and by web campaigns, by bloggers and virtual networks, and influencing or attempting to influence elections hither and yon, giving power to the people, if all goes well. Tonight, our speakers will share their own histories of activism and debate the outcome and the legacy of the 1960s and the Summer of Love. David Harris was a draft resister, a journalist, and a historian. He founded the Resistance, a group that encouraged draft resistance as a means to ending the Vietnam War, and served 20 years in a federal prison.
20 months.
It seemed like 20 years, I'll bet.
They're going to come back and make me do the rest of it if you keep this up.
I'm sorry about that, David. And we're happy to see him here today, has published many books, and in the last few years, they include Dreams Die Hard. His new book is called The Crisis, and it's an account of the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979. Joan Blades co-founded MoveOn.org with what began as a petition to move on from the Clinton impeachment, and it grew into a group of over 3.3 million members. It's aimed at bringing citizens back into the democratic process. More recently, Ms. Blades co-founded Moms Rising, a nonpartisan force dedicated to sharing a common concern about the need to build a more friendly family and family-friendly America. She also serves on the advisory board of Reuniting America, and she's the co-author of the Motherhood Manifesto. And I'm very pleased to welcome them here tonight. David Harris, we were talking about the Summer of Love, but it wasn't always that lovely for you, was it?
Well, it wasn't all that lovely for everybody. It was, you know, it was certainly a time to hang your hat on in terms of looking back and trying to find what was going on at the time. But there was a lot before it and a lot after it. And the context, of course, was we were engaged while the Summer of Love was going on, the country was engaged up to its eyeballs in an ugly war that lasted more than a decade and brought shame on the country that it still hasn't exacerbated.
Do you ever think these days, why can't these young people get it? Because we got it back then?
Well, to reveal my true old fart status, I suppose I do that occasionally, absolutely. But that sounds more blaming than I feel, you know. What I spend more time doing is looking and saying, Jesus, this is the exact same thing happening all over again. I mean, the deja vu is extraordinary, that down to the infinite little details. So Santana's comment about those who don't learn history repeating it seems to be being borne out in our daily lives, and I feel that all the time. You know, how could these guys, how could they miss this? But I felt at the end of the war the same way, and I felt since the end of the Vietnam War, throughout, I've always felt that, which is we are not processing this. We as a society have not sat down and said, what happened? How did it happen? Who were we that made it happen? We haven't gone through that as a process. Instead, we just decided that that the war had been a bad thing, but we really couldn't talk openly that way, so we just called it a mistake. And mistake became the shorthand for not talking about the war. I mean, some people thought it was a mistake because we didn't blast Hanoi into smithereens when we had the chance. And some people thought it was a mistake because it was a violation of the Nuremberg precedent. And, and everything in between was covered with mistake, and as a result, we never talked about what it was besides a mistake.
Many people don't know that you were Stanford student body president, right?
My initial claim to fame, someone with my politics, which were, at the time I was elected student body president, were anti-war, and our platform included abolishing the Board of Trustees and legalizing marijuana, giving women the same rights as men. It was considered over the top, although I wouldn't have been noticed much if I'd been at Berkeley. But I was at Stanford, so if someone like me could be Stanford student body president, who won by the biggest margin in the biggest turnout in the history of student elections at Stanford, then something strange must be going on. So I got to be the recipient of a small amount of celebrityhood.
Right. Speaking of Berkeley, did you know that Joan Blades was born in Berkeley? Yeah, that's true. And it was a sleepy little college town when you were growing up, wasn't it?
It was. It was where my parents moved from San Francisco to be in a nice, quiet college town with good schools. Mm-hmm. And I like to think I was well-educated.
And what happened? It got less quiet.
It definitely became less quiet sometime in my early teens. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten quieter again, to be honest.
Really?
Well, I'd say at the university it certainly is.
Some of us remember Berkeley as the site of the birth of the free speech movement and Mario Savio in 1964 and all that. Did this environment in some way influence you to become an activist later on and to, you know, develop MoveOn.org?
Probably in a historical context, but mm-hmm. I was fairly young at the time. Mm-hmm. And really starting MoveOn had more to do with the fact that I'm a mediator by training and by origin, right. And Wes and I were business people with a kind of a business background, and we were 6 months into the impeachment fiasco and hearing yet another group of people talking about the insanity of having our government obsessed with and media obsessed with impeachment, and thinking, don't we have some actual work to be doing? So mm-hmm. we wrote a one-sentence petition, Congress must immediately censure the president and move on to pressing issues facing the nation. And we sent it out to under 100 of our friends and families. And within a week, we had 100,000 people sign that petition. And since that time, I've been learning about helping citizens be heard and be part of the political dialogue, which has been quite an education. And I've got to start, then.
How does something like that catch fire like that? I mean, was there a vacuum, a paucity of leadership, or what was it?
I think you heard me earlier. Yes. That's how we explain it, is we would say that there was a vacuum of leadership at that time. You know, someone saying the sensible thing, censure the president and move on to pressing issues facing the nation. Mm-hmm. You could be a conservative, a liberal. You know, we had Republicans, Democrats, Green Party, Libertarians, Independents. Most of America could agree with that. You know, that was a period of intense polarization that was our politicians not doing right by us, because really we need to be able to work together. And I hate to say it, but we're still suffering from a tremendous amount of polarization, and we need to start finding ways to work together, because there are issues that we're going to have to address together as one nation.
You know, David Harris, when the peace movement began, a lot of people don't seem to realize that the civil rights movement had much to do with the momentum that it gathered.
The civil rights movement was where it all started, and certainly that was true for me personally. I left to Stanford briefly during my sophomore year. I was 18 years old and went to Mississippi to work in what was called the Mississippi Project, to try and get black people in Mississippi the right to vote without being lynched for trying to do so. And that confrontation that happened in Mississippi really set the framework for the entire rest of the decade. And it's certainly where I learned about organizing and where I learned about the power people have if they stand up. I mean, one of the most extraordinary things about the Mississippi Project was just the kind of courage that was involved on a daily anonymous basis. You know, that you would see people in these little towns in Mississippi who would go out and risk everything for the right to vote. I remember, I was a field worker in Quitman County, Mississippi, and there was a woman who was part of the organization there who was 75-some-odd years old, went down to the county seat to register to vote. When she tried to register to vote, they arrested her, threw her in jail. In jail, they tortured her with an electric cattle prod, and then finally, after several days, released her. This woman, whose name has disappeared, I have no idea what it is anymore. This woman walked out of the jail, walked down the street to the county courthouse, walked in and said, I want to register to vote. And people were prepared to do that, which suddenly put everything else in perspective and gave us a perspective on America that we hadn't had before. Young white boys coming out of Stanford and Yale and places like that, walking into black Mississippi and suddenly being treated like a black person was an experience that let you see that America was not what we had learned about in high school civics. And the sense of personal outrage that accompanied that was enormous because, you know, the people who were part of the movement in the 60s weren't there because they were red diaper babies. They weren't there because they had had political upbringings. They were there because they got A's in high school civics. They believed it. We all believed it, and which made our anger at the fact that what we had been taught to believe did not exist extraordinary, that carried through the entire decade. That was certainly where the early anti-war movement came back. I mean, I came back from Mississippi and marched my first march against the war in Vietnam within 6 months after I was back from Mississippi and devoted the rest of my decade to that and spent a total of 10 years both in prison and out of prison trying to stop it. It was for us always, I mean, there was no internet, it was not an information age in the current sense of the information age, but it was an age of deep moral perspective, and it was a moral confrontation. We were out there not just because this was bad policy. We were out there because this was evil, because this was wrong, because the primary intellectual example held up to us when we were growing up was the World War II experience and the German experience from World War II that Hannah Arendt was kind of the framer of for intellectually for my generation. She did this book about Eichmann in which she posed what she saw was the central question given us by Nazis, which was not what do you do if you're faced with people like Nazis. The question is, what do you do if you are a Nazi? What do you do if your country is the Nazi country? And my generation got to answer that question in real life. And the answer was you resist. And you resist with everything that you have. And in our case, we organized civil disobedience against the conscription laws that were feeding the war. And every violation of a conscription act was worth 5 years in prison. I once totaled it up that I had, for every piece of advocacy, you would get another 5 years, that I had some 5,000 plus years coming to me, and at that point I stopped counting. But we were out to make a confrontation and throw our bodies on the cogs of the machine and make it stop, or at least if it was going to go forward, it would not go forward with our connivance.
John, are there different kinds of questions that have to be answered these days as you go about your, collecting activists?
Willie, I have a deep belief in the power of grassroots organizing, and the fact that we have 3.3 million members at Move On, and now I have a new group called Moms Rising that we have over 100,000 already in just a year. It's about finding ways for people to participate in the political voice, and it's really been extraordinary getting to work with all these different people in different ways. I remember early on with the Move On petition, most of the people that participated, the first 500,000, and that was kind of extraordinary in 98 for 500,000 people to show up online for a petition, that all of a sudden we had to figure out, okay, how do we help these people be heard, and we could give them instantaneously the numbers of their representatives. We could tell them what was happening, what votes were coming up, and we were able to organize in a week for constituent meetings, in-person member constituent meetings, with people going in and presenting the petitions, which was powerful. It was the first time these people had gotten involved in politics, and here they are going into their representative's office. And, you know, some of them, we had stories coming back about having lunch with the rep or tea with the representative. Most of them, they just delivered it to staffers. But, you know, it was citizens becoming empowered. And we've been learning about that over the last eight, almost 9 years now. You know, we did the Bush in 30 Seconds ads, and there's a book called The Wisdom of Crowds, and I think that's what Move On and any good online organization does, is they take advantage of this wonderful group of people that have said, I care. And these ideas come in, and in this case we said, all right, what is it that you want to say? And we had over 1,000 ads submitted, which the Move On members then rated. And then they were ready to pay $1 million to have it shown on the Super Bowl. Now, that takes us into another very interesting question, because it was not allowed on the Super Bowl because it was advocacy. And yet that was the time Jackson, what's her first name again? She had that.
Janet.
She had a technical problem with her outfit,
yes.
I'm told.
A wardrobe dysfunction.
A wardrobe dysfunction, yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. But they would not allow us to have our ad on, which was this eloquent ad that the Move On members had chosen of children, small children working at blue-collar jobs with this music behind it, and then just who's going to pay for the, at that time, I think it was only $1 billion deficit, but, you know, it was who's going to pay? And that is the primary question. And people say, well, Move On, isn't it just the progressives talking to the progressives? No, that was the progressives wanting to talk to all of America, finding that common ground where we are together. But that, and, you know, now we have Operation Democracy, where we have, you know, hundreds of groups of Move On members getting together in person, showing up, and, you know, bird dogging. Mm-hmm. You know, we just today actually have deployed to 41 Republican congressional districts where we have people supporting the war. Move On members are going to underscore this is an unpopular war. These representatives need to start voting to get us out of that war. You know, it's about, you know, the only way we're going to win this is with citizens stepping forward and taking responsibility, because we're powerful together, and we're still just, I feel like we're still just scratching the surface. We have a lot more to learn and figure out. I could go on, you know, in terms of fundraising.
Yeah.
We've got problems because most of elected people are dependent on rich people and corporations for their money. Well, we've found that we can now support people running on $50 contributions, lots of them. And it's working. You know, in 2004, Move On raised in total $60 million. It's just like jaw-dropping. It's hard to fathom. But the average contributions, they're small. And we can do it. But it's going to take real engagement and at the level people are able to play. Because some people, you know, can show up at the constituent office. Some are single moms, and they just get home. They've worked. They got to get the kids fed and to bed. But then after the kid goes to sleep, they sign a petition. And we'll help deliver that petition. And that's, you know, we're taking care of each other. So it's hopeful.
Hopeful. For those of you who are listening on the radio, this is the Commonwealth Club broadcast from San Francisco, and we're talking with Joan Blades, the founder of MoveOn.org, and with David Harris, who is a journalist and historian and a figure who was very well known in the 1960s. David, did you ever think, or recently ever think that, gee, if we had the internet back then, this all would have been taken care of in short order.
Well, you know, one thing I've learned over my life spent organizing is that it's not the technique. It's not that there are no technical solutions. I would have loved to have the internet. You know, it would have made all kinds of communication far more easy than it was. You know, we were working with mimeograph machines when we started out. You know, we had a press out in the garage. You know, it was a big production to have a leaflet, for Christ's sake. You know, much less be able to send notices to 8 billion people with a push of the finger. That all sounds great, but it's no substitute. You know, ultimately, it is the resolve of people themselves that makes the difference in whatever the historical period. And what I liked about our time, more so than I do today, is just the degree to which we took it personally. You know, this was not about issues. This was, although issues were certainly abundant. And this was not about policy, although policy was discussed endlessly. This was really about who are you? What kind of human being are you? Are you the kind of human being that stands back and watches innocent people in their huts be burned to death for no good reason by the people you pay your tax dollars to or by you yourself? Are you that kind of person? If you are, all you had to do was sit tight. Just being a citizen of the United States would get you that status. But if you weren't that kind of person, then you had to stand up somehow. You had to step out. You had to find some way to grapple with that machine. You had to find some way to stand on the side of those people who were in that hut facing death in the ugliest possible terms for no good reason. Somehow you had to find a way to act for those people. And it wasn't something you could escape. In the 1960s, for all of its flaws, and there were numerous, believe me, the myths that have come down over the ages can be dispensed as myths. But the one nice thing there was that bystander status was not acceptable. It was not good enough to say, I'm going to watch and see how this comes out, or I'm going to take care of my own ass first, or I'm going to, you know, that was not acceptable. The other thing that was good about those days is that whichever side you were on the questions of the day, there was an implicit sense of obligation that you had to engage the other side, that there was a responsibility to engage in a kind of mutual dialogue of the body politic. And so that even if people disagreed with you, there was still a kind of interchange that happened. These days, when you want to talk to strangers or talk to people who disagree with you, it's a far more difficult task to find them. And then to find people who are prepared to listen to each other, whereas we accepted it as a normal, as a kind of given that you would. But, you know, I think both of those questions are not questions that are solved by the Internet. My worries about the Internet are simply that it can be enormously self-selecting and anonymous, and that part of the reason we're in the spot we're in is the degree to which we have let anonymity come to dominate our worldview and our capacity to make entire peoples halfway around the world anonymous is what allows us to do to them what we have been doing to them. And that somehow our task is not just to make contact with each other and just to make contact with other people who disagree with us, but somehow to speak directly to that anonymity so that we all end up facing each other as human beings with names, faces, and lives attached. And the little box that sits on the table in your office or that you carry in your backpack around with you doesn't solve those questions. It just gives you a different kind of tool to wrap around them.
Well, I have to at least speak up. I mean, I'm dealing with the activists today, and it's very personal. It just depends who you're exposed to. I'm sure I would have found it very personal in 64, too, but it's very personal to the Move On membership. And you know, that box in the backpack is basically the Internet is the equivalent of your telephone on steroids. You know, it's a way of communicating. It's a tool. And that's what it is. It's a superb tool for helping people communicate. And we're actually, as a society, And as a democracy, I think deeply at risk because our public square has diminished so dramatically in the last decades. Our public square is no longer in the town. It's at the mall, which is privately owned, and we've had MoveOn members kicked out of the mall because public speech can be kicked out of the mall. It's not a public square. We've had media consolidation to the point where what we are understanding when we go to the polls about what the facts are completely divergent. I mean, I've been deeply troubled that a majority of the people that voted for our current president in 2004 believed weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq and that there was a link with al-Qaeda. Our media ceased to do what we desperately needed to do. And the internet, this form of communication, this person to person, because people do care and do reach out, that's what I'm counting on. And I hope something else really strong and powerful emerges as well. Text messaging and cell phones, these are other ways to get to a broader audience. But we really have to get serious about bringing the democracy, the D back in democracy, you know, with the important part of it.
David, you got kicked out of the mall in a big way.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
And I imagine you didn't have too much patience with many of us who thought that the Summer of Love and the Era was a big party. And it was a big party.
And I will confess in front to having partaken of the party. I mean, I don't want to come off here as the kind of Stalinist in the group. You know, I took more than my share of acid, and I rolled around on Golden Gate Park. And, you know, when I ran for student body president at Stanford, the one large rally we had, the sound system was acquired from the Jefferson airplane by trading a lid of weed to get their sound system for a day. So I don't want to make it sound like I missed sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but I did have a large dispute with a kind of hippie ethos that said that somehow, well, you got to get yourself right first, and you got to make peace inside yourself, and when you make peace inside yourself, then you'll be ready to make peace with the country. And, you know, I thought that was horseshit, and I still do. You know, I'm all for making peace inside yourself. I'm a serious, committed Buddhist, and I try search every morning in my meditation for finding that peace inside myself and attaching myself to it. That said, that does not stop governments from dispatching armies. This is serious business, and if you're going to stop armies, then you got to be serious about it. And that party all you want, that's fine by me. But at some point, you got to be counted. And what we were saying to people is, how can you party with a draft card in your pocket? And for those of you who missed the historical reference here, briefly, the Selective Service System, which administered military conscription, registered every young man when he turned 18 by law. If you didn't register, you were subject to 5 years in prison. And when you registered, you were given two cards, one signifying that you had been registered with the system, second signifying what you were classified as in terms of when you were going to be called. And you were by law required to keep those on your possession at all times. To be caught by the police without such identification on you was, again, according to the law, subject to 5 years in prison. So that draft card became a symbol. And so what we would say to people is, how can you party here with that draft card in your back pocket? You know, if you're really serious about making peace with whatever, then you got to get rid of that first, because as long as you got that in your pocket, you belong to them, and you're being used to send kids to kill other kids in Southeast Asia. And the only way is to make peace is to step outside of that pattern. So party, okay, but when push comes to shove, you got to get real about how wars are made and how wars are stopped. And it requires people willing to sacrifice their image, perhaps, their good name. I mean, remember, one of the great differences between that period of time and this period of time was the first thing we encountered in the anti-war movement was the assumption on the part of the general population that you were not allowed to criticize the government at wartime. Mm-hmm. This was left over from World War II. So we spent the first year of the anti-war movement trying to convince people that it was all right to come out and say what they felt about the war, that this was not by definition being unpatriotic or subversive. So in that context, we tried to get people to take control of their own lives and to step them out of the system that was feeding, ultimately, the meat grinder out in Southeast Asia.
Joan, I imagine you think it's all right to criticize the government during wartime.
Well, I think I've been accused of doing that, in fact.
But, shocking.
Yeah, shocking. But, you know, that is an important factor. We still have a percentage of the government that's saying that we shouldn't. And we've yelled like murder that that's not, in fact, the case. And we are working with some of the models from the 60s have been very good. The veterans group that, you know, we're working in coalition with, their voices are some of the most powerful voices to speak out against the war, and they're crucial. And, you know, so there were lessons learned in the peace movement, and I am very hopeful that that and much more is going to cause this war to be ended much sooner. That is the intent of a huge number of citizens. This war is hugely unpopular for many very good reasons. You know, the fact that we shouldn't have gone there in the first place. One of the things I really think was amazing is prior to the start of this war, there was the largest anti-war demonstrations in the history of the world, and they wrapped around the world. You know, you may recall the Millennium celebrations. They took years to plan that. But in approximately a week, the plan for vigils going around the world, and they did. The pictures from around the world are amazing prior to the war. Now, it's heartbreaking that the war happened even so, but that is ultimately where we need to go. We need to go to the place where we can stop wars before they start, and that means electing people that won't take us to law. It means de-alerting nuclear weapons. It means not building more nuclear weapons. It means having international relations that are ready to deal with the issues that come up through diplomatic means. And it requires an active citizenry that insists upon good information and makes sure their leaders are using it. It's a lot of work. It's so much harder to do this than I want it to be, but it's with very good people that I'm doing it. So I thank many of the people here who I know are part of that.
It's curious that one of the ironies of the current moment is that the success of the 60s in some ways worked against the impact of the current. And I was just thinking of demonstrations. You know, in our day, when we could get 100 people out to march against the war, it got enormous attention because nobody had ever seen anybody doing this kind of stuff before. It was like, what? They're doing what? You know, you became a kind of curiosity. So there was an automatic kind of attention focus that belied the poor numbers that we could actually turn out. So that now when you turn out 250,000 people in San Francisco and, you know, 1 million people in London and, you know, on and on and on and on, there's a certain kind of ho-hum thing that goes on because people are, by this point in time, have become so inured to the fact that there are demonstrations that they don't have nearly the impact or draw nearly the attention that they once did, which is not a reason not to have them, by the way. I think those demonstrations, even though they didn't stop the war, were an enormous positive for the movement and I think ultimately made an extraordinary amount of difference. And, you know, I think led directly to the kind of majority we have today from what was at that point in time an extraordinarily minority position inside the United States.
You know, David, to get back to a little history, which intrigues me, of course, is I'm sure you've thought about how the administration is run by some figures from the Nixon administration, And they have reemerged or didn't go away? Or what do you think about
well, they've gotten a lot worse. You know, I mean, I never thought I'd miss Richard Nixon. I never, you know. If you could have knocked me over with a pole in 1975 if you told me I was going to miss Richard Nixon. But, boy, Richard Nixon looks like good government compared to these idiots. There's a certain thing that happens when you're the same age as the president because you know who the guy is. You know, and I can see George Bush wearing his Beta jacket, puking all over his penny loafers out in front of the Beta house on Saturday night. You know, it's like being governed by the Interfraternity Council. I mean, it's like, no, this can't be really happening to us. This guy? Oh, my God. You know, and I certainly have that feeling about this whole government, in large part because they are the contradiction to the rule that we always tried to follow when we organized in the 60s. Our first rule was do it yourself first, then talk about it. That you couldn't organize draft resistance unless you were a draft resister. If you had taken the steps that were putting you vulnerable to 5 years in prison, then you could talk to other people about putting themselves in that position. But you couldn't do it before that. These guys are all these armchair warriors. You know, they all had their chance back in the day. You know, any one of these guys who wanted to volunteer and go be gung-ho out in the jungle outside of Da Nang could have done so in a hot minute. They were taken, guys, believe me. They all had their chance. All of them missed it. All of them used whatever means they could to stay out of it, including the president himself, who got to drive jets around and play flyboy at home while there were guys out dying in the high grass. And now these sons of bitches want to turn around decades later and use the experience of those young boys who they sent out there and didn't go join to somehow leverage their policy for sending more young boys out to do the exact goddamn thing they sent them down the rat hole to do the last time. These guys have not paid any kind of personal price. They have not ever put their asses out on the line where they got to be vulnerable. They've always specialized in making other people vulnerable and in the service of the ideology that they came to articulate. And I find that as somebody who paid prices. And for my generation, you know, I found a great solidarity amongst all the people who paid prices, whatever the way that happened. You know, like I've always been very close with Vietnam veterans. I've served on the board of a veterans organization. You know, I've organized with Vietnam veterans, and Vietnam veterans and draft resistors all understood each other right away. We both had paid prices. We knew exactly where the other guys were. And I have a respect for paying prices. I believe that by paying prices is one of the ways that you get stature and credibility, and you earn the right to be believed. And these clowns never earned the right to be believed anywhere along the line. Except if you count service in Washington, D.C., which I don't. So it's deja vu all over again.
Joan Blades, many of us think of MoveOn.org and think of the anti-war movement and the Iraq war. But there's more involved here. What kind of pressing issues should young people be really, really worried about?
Well, the Iraq war has certainly been one of our top issues, but our members have also said, you know, what is the positive agenda? What is the progressive agenda? And we had house parties over a year ago where Move On members got together and went in deep because, you know, we're constantly getting feedback from our members in the forms of doing surveys, getting emails, and because for us to do our job well, we have to be listening to our members. But to really understand and go deep. We put together a process and we came out with 10 items that we put out to the entire Move On base from, you know, those folks that had gotten together. And the top issues for Move On members, global warming and energy, you know, that's a piece, healthcare for all, and restoring democracy, which I actually think is a really good reflection of the American public in general. Now, the Iraq war is, you know, kind of overwhelming everything else, and yet we have this issue, global warming, which is the issue of this century, and we have to pay attention to it today to be effective. You know, it's the sort of thing where if we do not pay attention to this, and we now have overwhelming scientific evidence that global warming is being caused by humans, the chance we are taking, it's not proven exactly what will happen, but one of those chances is the end of, you know, our Earth as we know it, and that's not acceptable. It's like playing Russian roulette with our future. And as a parent, I will not have that. This is not okay. And that's the place where we truly are going to have to start having a dialogue that is all the citizens talking together, because it's going to cause the need for World War II kind of commitment and dedication. Now, the upside of this is we'll be a healthier world. It can, in fact, be very good for our economy, but people don't like to change. And change is frightening to people. And we need to come to this together. And as long as we're approaching this in such a way as my team and your team, we're not focusing on the issue, and we're not going to be serving our future, our collective future, well.
The political challenge is that you know, to respond to this as opposed to just stopping a war policy, which you can do with a majority, to really deal with global warming, we're going to have to talk about building a 70% majority at the least. There has to be something that translates as consensus, not just in this country, but around the world, you know, that which is a political challenge unlike any that we have ever faced before. And to make the changes we need to make to survive is going to require us to come together in a way that we have yet to ever do. And it's going to require jettisoning a lot of what we have accepted as social organization. And the sooner we get after it, the better.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club broadcast from San Francisco, and we're going to be taking some of your questions in about 5 minutes. So feel free to start lining up at the microphone here, and we'd be looking forward to hearing your questions. Joan, do you ever think this is all so overwhelming? I mean, your projects are so terribly ambitious.
Well, yes, it's definitely overwhelming. On the other hand, I am a parent. Now, last year, I started an organization, MomsRising.org, because, you know, I was specifically looking for bridge building and finding a whole set of issues where we could all get together. And the fact is, you know, as a country, we do a very poor job of taking care of families. We're working with a 1950s expectation of what is work and family are supposed to be like, yet most families, both parents need to work, and so we're finding kids aren't getting taken care of. And this is there's a bias against mothers in hiring. Identical resumes sent out, and 44% less likely to hire a mother. Same qualifications, offered $11,000 less for the same job. It's not that there's a bias against women these days. There's a bias against mothers. And if you're a single mother, that's about a 40% less that you would get paid for if you're equally educated. It's really an easy answer to figure out why there's so many women and children in poverty when you start looking at all the data. And yet you're going, well, we don't hate mothers, do we? You know, we may not all be mothers, but we had mothers pretty universally. But the fact is, this bias against mothers is undermining their ability to take care of their kids. And we can and need to start paying attention to this issue, too, because as a country, we're going to, in 20 years, really have the engine of our economy that we haven't allowed parents to take care of their kids. And so Moms Rising started a new, we have 100,000 members with Moms Rising now, and we actually succeeded in, it's one nice thing is smaller numbers actually are effective in this area. In Washington State, we passed paid family leave This year. California is the only state in the union up until this year that had paid family leave. And out of 173 countries worldwide, there happen to be four that don't have paid leave for new mothers. That would be the U.S., Papua New Guinea, Swaziland, and Lesotho. Yeah, I'm serious. This is a Harvard-McGill study. Because, well, as one Arab woman that was kind of thought it was a joke when Kim Gandhi, the president of Now, told her that there's no paid family leave, government-required paid family leave in this country. And she realized it. Well, then how do they feed their children? So we have mothers going back to work in this country just weeks after giving birth because we're so hardworking, and you can't afford to stay home and take care of our kids.
Just on the note of overwhelming,
yeah,
I think overwhelming is one of those words you really have to put in perspective. You want overwhelming? Try being a black sharecropper in Quitman County, Mississippi, having spent 200 years in slavery and another 100 years in the next closest thing to slavery, and deciding at that point that somehow you're going to take control of the government that has been imprisoning you for 300 years. That's overwhelming. The rest, and that was done. Those people with the least power turned it all over. And so whenever we feel overwhelmed, and we all feel overwhelmed if we care about things in this world, whenever you feel overwhelmed, remember that it is a transitory feeling, that the next step after overwhelmed is to grapple. And when you grapple, suddenly you're not overwhelmed anymore.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and we're talking to David Harris, and we're talking to Joan Blades, and we have a question from our audience.
Good evening. My name's Patricia Royman, and it's an honor to listen to both of you. Am I allowed more than one question?
Go ahead, shoot.
Okay. To David first, I was just in Sitak, Croatia at a peace conference, and probably some of the people you worked with in the 60s were there and speaking. And I went with a certain perspective, and I met a man from Bosnia, from Sarajevo, who fought in that war, lost a leg, was full of shrapnel. Very educated man, political science, psychology, philosophy. Won the first Purple Heart for a foreigner. I was pretty detached from what occurred there, so it was interesting to hear his story, and I'll be brief. He said he would fight with the United States for democracy anywhere because he was protecting his family and friends and children when he fought. So you had associated yourself with veterans and understand both sides of that story. So I don't have a conclusion. It just moved me deeply to meet him and meet a woman from Bosnia, a very classy, very educated woman who stayed and hid the soldiers and dressed them and fed them and did their laundry. So that's just, I don't know if you even want to comment on that, but it moved me.
I would just say that the really operative phrase here is fighting for democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think the questions that have to be raised, given his experience, given the experience that we're in the middle of in Iraq, given the experience that my entire generation went through in Vietnam, yeah, is that when is it that these giant armies we dispatch around the world actually fight for democracy?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when is it that they act democracy out? When is it that they leave democracy in their wake? What is it about democracy that you think can be installed at the point of a gun? And I think we have shown that we can defend ourselves with our armies. And there are certainly times in life when you may need to defend yourself. I have no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have not shown that there is some way to send an army halfway around the world and install democracy by kicking in people's doors and chaining up the people we don't like and imprisoning them and torturing them. That mm-hmm. that has not shown great results as far as democracy goes.
Did you have a quick second question?
Uh, Boy, I have two.
All right.
Habeas corpus, I've read that that's kind of the giant issue right now, and it's to David and Joan. For people like David who marched in the streets and went to jail, now you could go somewhere quiet and never be heard from again. It's a tough decision. Do you think that affects Americans and our willingness to be as fearless as you were?
I don't think we fully understand how horrendous it is that that has been undercut. Though I think there is a place where we can have a bipartisan restoration of habeas corpus. I think that will happen. Mm-hmm. And I think the sooner it happens, the better.
Are you that optimistic?
Plus, remembering the myth breaking here, we were fearful. We were scared shitless. Taking on 19 years old, taking on the government of the United States of America. Whoa! You know, what am I doing here? You know, you felt that every day. But the issue is not whether you get scared. The issue is what do you do after you're scared? And I don't think that's what's inhibiting Americans. Although I think that the issue of sacrifice is a difficult one for most people to swallow. And the notion of letting go of parts of your life is hard for people. And certainly a lot more of my generation faced real jail time or had the experience of going to jail than people are having these days, because civil disobedience has not been a large part of this movement. But certainly it was part of the experience back in the 60s, and so people came to be a little inured to it.
Thank you. We're going to have to move on, forgive the expression, to the next nice lady.
Hi, thank you for being here. Joan, I was wondering with MoveOn.org, if you've done any surveys of who are the 3 million members. Are they the red states in the middle and most of America, blue states? Are they the informed 20s and 30s group like us or our grandchildren? Who are these 3 million people?
You know, that's a great question. We do know geographically because we match everyone to their representatives, and they are spread throughout the country. Sometimes I wish we had more people in North Dakota. So please, if you have friends in North Dakota, get them signed up. I don't see enough dots there. If you go to some of the MoveOn parties, you'll see the dots appearing on the map where all the different parties are. I want more parties in North Dakota. Too many cows, not enough parties. In terms of the demographics, when we've checked, we're a little bit younger than the average voter. And we mostly know about what our members believe in. We haven't asked lots about the demographics. So, but it's a group that, as they get engaged, I find they become more engaged and more understanding of how the whole process is interconnected. And I think it's hugely important because, you know, we did a net neutrality piece. And we're still working on net neutrality so that there's not a two-tiered internet, which, if that were to happen, the next move on would likely not happen. And we want more innovation. You know, the vibrancy, the public space online has become, I think, one of the most exciting public spaces. And we need to protect that. Well, you know, people come in on one issue where we've given an opportunity to help people be heard, and in the process, a lot of increasing sophistication grows.
Thank you.
You know, one of the differences between now and then, since we have one of the themes tonight, is simply that kind of demographic spread. You know, in the 60s, it all started with young people. You know, when we had our marches against the war, unlike the ones that you participated in here on Market Street, if you looked around the crowd, 90% of the crowd, at least, was under the age of 25. And our task was how to break out of that kind of isolation on college campuses and how to go out and connect to the rest of the population, having nurtured what we were doing in kind of the safer atmosphere of the college campus, but how to go out and reach out And it was ultimately when we succeeded in being able to do that that we could actually force the politics of the war to stop.
But is there something we should know about North Dakota?
There are lots of things you should know about North Dakota, but this is a family program. So,
well, there go our listeners in Bismarck. Next gentleman here, thank you.
Yes, I'd just like to express my gratitude for both of you for being here and speaking to this. I'd especially like to thank David Harris. David Harris is another person who changed my life. I realize, David, you will not remember me, but I met you in 69 with David Bolduc in Denver, and we visited you in Safford briefly when we broke into the minimum security prison there and came in to see the guys who were there. But my key thing that I wanted to ask you about a little bit is in terms of both you, David, and perhaps your perspective on it, Joan, in terms of mobilization, in terms of changing the world and so forth. I mean, I was reading through a couple of David's titles here, the Old Goliath book and the Our War book, and I think there's a phrase, I can't remember how you put it, but you get what you do. And my question really is particularly when you mention now your meditation practice and your mindfulness practice and sort of that view, I've talked with some people who are from those traditions, and they look at this sort of for the long haul, you know, decades, scores of years, et cetera. So I'm interested in your thoughts about how we might bring more of a sense of personal interbeing and presence and the way we interact with each other to this process that you've both had in very different ways, marvelous results in transforming and touching people's lives. So,
well, I think the elements that kind of need to be added to the mix, because everybody brings fervor and there is dedication and all that, I think patience and humility are both facets we're going to have to nurture, because if for no other reason, they help us talk to other people. And somehow we're going to have to find a way to be that lets us bridge the kind of civil war that's going on right now, where everybody is locked into this kind of you're with us and you're against us. Getting people to be able to take a step back so that we can talk seriously about what we need to do as a people from this point on is a great challenge, and we're going to have to find some way to take some of the implicit antagonism out of confrontation and add a kind of gentleness to us that lets us get up close.
Thank you. Sir?
Hi, David and Joan. Nice to hear you speak. My name's David. And I have a question for both of you. It's a perception followed by a question. And I'm the tail end of the baby boomer generation, and we have the X and Y and millennium generation coming up where their attention spans are very short, and they're a generation of digitized, individualized existence where they can tune the world out with an earplug or a volume control. The triggers that mobilized a nation during your time period, David, like the draft, don't exist today. And now we have an online forum where people talk a lot, but I don't know if these generations can be mobilized without a trigger like you had back in the 60s.
I would say we have some very substantial triggers. And, you know, one of the triggers is certainly this war, because that's something that is touching us deeply.
I should qualify that as sustained longevity to a movement.
A lot of the members of Move On have been with us for a long time, and most people that have worked in the peace movement know, unfortunately, things most often don't get resolved quickly. These people have been working hard, and they've been working hard for years now. And what's so, you know, inspiring about it is we have setbacks, and they just become more clear that we have got to succeed. Yeah, failure is not an option. And I think when we look at, you know, these other issues, global warming being primary among them, listen to my son's commencement speech, and it was
head of the Ella Baker Center was giving it, and of course I'm blocking on his name right now because I know him well. But he was saying, he was talking about the challenges. You are so lucky. We haven't had anything great like this to challenge us. World War II was a great challenge. We now have a great challenge that will call to us to do great things. That's what we're looking for from this generation, these generations coming up. And I believe they will rise to that occasion because human beings are amazing. And
well, you know, I've fathered two members of these generations. So, you know, the sense of remoteness isn't quite there. But, you know, I think it's almost a language issue in the sense that for our generation, and I was the front end of the baby boomers, you know, we lived in a remarkably unitary culture. You know, for a young man growing up in the 1950s, as I did, your option was to either be John Wayne in the sands of Iwo Jima or be John Wayne in the sands of Iwo Jima or be John Wayne in the sands of Iwo Jima. That was it. You know, that, and the culture was monolithic, to say the least. There were no options. So the paradigm for us was how to make options. It's why things like the Summer of Love happened, was because there weren't any options. So we went out to make our own options. And so it was a process of taking a blank spot and filling it in. For this generation of people, that option question has been resolved by the 60s. We set forces in motion that suddenly make us options. We got so many options. We got 800,000 television channels, for Christ's sake. I mean, it just pays you a day just to click your way through all the whole thing. There are options every place you turn. And so the paradigm suddenly becomes not how do you fill the blank spot, but how do you make enough space so that you can figure out which of these options makes sense to do. And it's a different kind of paradigm. And I think it requires those from my generation to understand that and to kind of wrap our minds around that this is a different kind of question here. And I think when we do that, I think we have a lot to contribute to the situation. I think the kind of intense concentration and moral purpose that really consumed our youth translates well today.
I'd like to. I have the answer, I think, to your question, but I'd like to preface it. As a Korean War veteran, people thank me for my service. I'd like to thank you for your ongoing service.
You.
If you look around the room, you'll see that it's 98% Caucasian, and I think the Commonwealth Club, which I love and I've been a member for about 20 years, is a very high percentage of Caucasian, which is true in many organizations. We live in, I think, in a very fragmented society in so many ways, economically, politically, socially, religiously, etc. I subscribe to the suggestion raised by Representative Charlie Rangel in the Congress, and now several others are going along with it. I would like to see a form of draft that would include a year and a half to 2 years of some form of government service, with maybe a military option for those that choose that. But I think that this would give people a common base of communication, because the suburbs don't talk to the inner city. There's zilch. There's no contact.
I think David would like to talk about the draft. That's
yeah.
a good idea.
And oh, by the way, no longer can women, you know, get equal rights without equal responsibilities. I think that's pretty well assumed. So I would not exempt people who have maybe minor disabilities, and I would give everybody a chance to serve, and either as early as 18 or not later than their 22nd birthday.
David?
Well, I think this liberal argument about the draft as the great social leveler really has to be addressed, because I debated Charles Rangel about this, and I disagree with him extraordinarily. I do not think it was the effect of military conscription was as a great equalizer, only in the same way as if we took everybody and locked them up in camps, it would be a great equalizer as well, and we would have a lot to talk about. but it's not a reason to do it. The military conscription is the most fundamental suspension of the American Constitution that is possible. Your life becomes a piece of property of the government to use as you saw fit. The last time these guys had a peacetime military conscription, starting in 1947, the effect was to give them a blank check that they could write in Washington, D.C. and cash on our asses out there in mainstream America. And I would not, in any circumstances, give these guys a blank check on American manpower. No way on God's good earth can you trust these people with the right to take the lives of young people and distribute them however they will. I believe in national service. Don't get me wrong. I'm all for national service. I'm all for a campaign of national service. I'm all for making as many instruments to serve the nation and serve the people of this country as possible. What's wrong with that being voluntary? That's what makes service service. Service when you're subject to 5 years in prison if you don't do it is not service. It is servitude. And I'm not going to... Only under the most extreme circumstances am I willing to do that. And if I were willing to do it, the only situation I would do it under was when everything and everybody got drafted, including every one of those tanks that they're going to roll out there for us to drive. Nobody gets to make profits off wars if you're going to draft its people to go out and fight them. If we reach such a dire circumstance where the entire nation must give up its rights, then everybody gives them up. What happened was, under military conscription, everybody under the age of 26 lost their rights. Everybody else had all the rights they wanted. And those people who lost their rights were as misused by the government as any generation of people has ever been. They were shipped down a rat hole for no good reason, and we had no way to stop them because these guys already had a blank check, and they were cashing it every day so that they could take the troop levels and start at 16,000, and within 2 years they were at 565,000. And we had no way to stop them. And as long as we are a nation of immigrants, and 50% of those immigrants that came over here, including my forefathers and probably your forefathers, came over here to get away from conscription. They came because they were being drafted into armies in Europe and they wanted to escape from that. And I don't think we should give that up. I think we fought long and hard, and people made enormous sacrifices to stop this system of conscription, and we did it. It was one of the great successes of the 60s, that suddenly, for the first time, young Americans did not have to face being a piece of government property when they got out of college or when they got out of high school. And I think that's an enormous accomplishment. And I'll fight tooth and nail to keep it forever from being rolled back. I do not think it serves any liberal good. I do think the draft made opposition more personal and more accessible to a lot of people. I grant you that. But I think, you get the same thing by lining people up against firing squads. And I'm not going to advocate that. I'm not going to advocate the conscription. I think it would be an enormous mistake. We need to go the opposite direction. We need to voluntarily give up our comfortable lives to go out and help the uncomfortable. We need to make this society work. Absolutely. We need to devote ourselves to public service. But none of that happens because the government says they're going to throw you in prison for 5 years if you don't. So no draft for me. Not this time, not next time.
We have time for one more question, please.
Thank you for speaking out on that last issue. I'm concerned about what's going to happen with this next election, and we still have so many states with elections done by the electronic voting machines. And both the Princeton study and the state of Florida study show that those cannot be made hacking proof. And I would like to know, is there, the Holt bill doesn't seem to be strong enough. Is there something else that we can support that will be for paper ballots that can be counted and saved and all that?
Well, my understanding is that what was becoming problematic was it going to happen in time for this election, for the paper ballots? And it was still up at odds. And state by state, it's been happening, the requirement of paper ballots. We want them all to have paper ballots or something that's reliable. Mail-in voting is actually a very
efficient high response way to get that. But it's something you should be concerned about and continue to, every time there's an opportunity, to push leadership in the direction of now having the paper ballots.
What do you think of the Holt bill?
What I know about the Holt bill is it would be a big improvement on what we've got now.
Uh-huh. I think it only says paper trail, though, not paper ballot.
Well, the paper trail is the same as the paper ballot. You know, fundamentally, you can't just have, you have to have something physical that will be saved in the case of a recount. Then you have, the paper is what you turn to. And I just find it absolutely jaw-dropping that we've had to work so hard to get what you get at the grocery store when you do a transaction or you go to your ATM. It's like it's new technology. But that's really all it is it's a piece of paper. You see it says you voted for the right person, and they save it. And it's pretty plain and simple. We just need it. Thank you.
1 minute.
Hey, this is, to me, an example of technology run amok. You know, the assumption that somehow we always need to apply every piece of new technology to every task we've got. We had a really good system. It was called paper and pencil and the machine that reads the pencil marks. Hey, what more do you need to run an election? And, we just added this piece of technology because it was out there possible to do, and there were a bunch of companies who knew a bunch of politicians who wanted to make sure that they got a chance to sell a lot of their machines, and all for no purpose, ultimately. No one has been better served by the addition of technology in that way, and I think I'm always one of those that feels good when we have a moment of rolling back misuses of technology. It's like when San Francisco tore down the skyway that used to overshadow this end of town. It was like this great sense of liberation. At last, you know, we've been able to get this somebody's monstrous dream out there that had been imposed on the rest of us. So I'm all for going back to paper.
We've been well served by our guests tonight. And please give a round of applause, if you would, to Joan Blades and David Harris. I'm Bruce Bellingham. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum is now adjourned.